and feeling the warmth on my skin and the beautiful, strangey, lacy pattern of the dappled sunlight. And it reminded me of a time when I was a kid, and it suddenly struck me that I was alive.
I am on the prowl indeed. Welcome to Podcats. This is Cats John Katsalamidis of the Las Vegas Review Journal. My column is called Cats, fittingly enough. Find it on page 3A every day and online all the time. My guest this week is an international recording star, but so much more. She has dedicated her art and fame into mental health, wellness, and awareness. She also has a new album coming out and a rich history in Las Vegas. She is the one and only Jewel. We are here with international recording artist Jewel. And Jewel, I can tell you it's a pleasure to talk to you again, first of all. Thank you for spending time with us on Podcats. Where are you these days? Where's home to you?
I'm currently in the Rockies, southwest of Colorado, a good place to hold up for quarantine.
You've been there pretty much the entire way, right?
Yes, yeah.
I think the last time we actually talked to each other, if I have this right, was when you were the focus of the One Night for One Drop Cirque du Soleil benefit show at Mandalay Bay. We covered that. I was had the pleasure of covering that and meeting your family and talking to you. It was great. It was. What are your memories of that? I think of that period of time, and it brings a smile to my face. It was such a beautiful performance. That was. When you look back, what do you think of that experience?
It was an honor to have my life story told by Cirque. It was an amazing experience as an artist as well. I think it was the first time they've ever allowed somebody to speak in Cirque too. So that was kind of neat.
Yeah,
every artist in that show was incredibly talented.
Oh, I'll tell you this, Jewel, too, and I know those guys. After that show, they, to a person, when I talked to them afterwards, they really enjoyed working with you. They were really, really complimentary, and that's true. That's from the after party on, and you're right about speaking on stage. It's you're the only person to have spoken English.
Right.
They invented a language. Yeah. They have that coded language that I once tried to dissect that language and put a glossary together, and I couldn't quite get there. But you did. You were the first and so far the only English speaking performer ever in a Cirque du Soleil production. So you have among your other benchmarks, you've got that going for you. I want to ask you first of all, if I could, about the song "Grateful." That came out early in April, and a little bit about that number, because it's a beautifully conceived song and expertly performed, of course. I'm wondering about when the song was written and what its original motivation was and how it's fit into what we're going through right now. Can you step me through that process?
My songwriting's always been an extension of my own life. Obviously, it's how singer-songwriters work. I've often needed my music to help me through difficult times. When I was living in my car when I was 18, I was homeless because I wouldn't have sex with a boss and I couldn't pay my rent. And I started living in my car, and then my car got stolen. I was having really bad panic attacks and was becoming agoraphobic, which is a fear of leaving your home, which is very exasperated when you don't have a home. And I started to make a lot of discoveries, one of which was that there are only two basic states of being. I either felt calm and open, or I felt tight and contracted. And I began to realize that every thought, feeling, or action led me to one of those two states. So I began to look at my anxiety as an ally instead of an enemy. Sorry, my son just came in. Scared me. And so I began looking at anxiety is this really, wonderful ally that made me realize one thought, feeling, or action I was just participating in didn't agree with me, as you would say, like food poisoning. If we eat something that isn't good for us, our body throws up. Anxiety is kind of like that, I realized. And I realized you can't be in two states at one time. And so if I was anxious, I would become very curious. What thought, feeling, or action was I just having? And I began to make a list. And so I had this list on the left side of things that dilated me and calmed me down, and a list of emotions, feelings, and actions that made me anxious. And I finally one day was on a street corner and I was about to head into a panic attack. And I decided to fully invest myself in a feeling of gratitude. And it was the first time I was able to ward off a panic attack. The simple power of gratitude, letting your whole body feel stimulated by this sensation of gratitude, is profound. And I've since learned the science behind it. Our body's listening to us. So our thoughts and feelings create biochemical responses. And when you find one that causes your whole system to dilate, it's literal. Your vascular system dilates, your blood pressure drops instantly, your neurotransmitters change to calmative neurochemicals instead of the excitatory, restrictive kind. And so something as simple as gratitude became a really profound part of my mental health practice, because it's the quickest way to hack your way out of anxiety.
But when that happened to you, Jill, if I could ask this this way, when that happened to you originally, you didn't have those, that education, did you, to head off a panic attack? I mean, you were going off instincts and intuitive processes when that first happened, right? I'm just wondering how you can, how you would know how to head off a panic attack with those tools, having not yet really been trained in them.
It was just discovery. I really believe that if you sit still and get quiet and observe, go into yourself, you're going to find ingenious solutions. Everybody can. I certainly didn't know that it changed my neurotransmitters or things like that, but I knew how my body felt. And so if you will become a little scientist and start to study yourself, and you can write down, all right, I'm anxious. I notice my body feels like I am really anxious. What was I just thinking? What was I just doing? And just take notes. You're going to start to see patterns. You're going to start to see your negative, quote unquote, self-talk. Again, that wasn't a term I knew, but that's what I was doing. I was able to see my thoughts in black and white. And I was able to study and say, right now I feel really calm and really good. What am I doing? What am I thinking? What am I feeling? And I just started to become very observant. I had read a lot of philosophy when I was young, and I remember reading Descartes and his famous phrase, I think, therefore I am. I began to realize that year it was that I perceive what I think, therefore I am. We're not our thoughts, we're the observer of them, and we can curate them. And not every thought and feeling is a fact. It's like we curate what we eat. If we can curate what we think, we're going to have a much more profound impact on the ability to create change in our lives. And that's what I was looking for. I knew I came from a difficult background, and I knew that happiness wasn't taught in my home, and I knew I had habits that I needed to change. And once I started learning that when you observed a thought and you created a gap before you acted on it, that gap was everything. That's where I could insert new education and wouldn't just go off of a neurological knee-jerk reaction. And those are the fundamentals of mindfulness. I didn't know the term mindfulness at the time, but again, if anybody sits still, we all have this amazing kind of intelligence and resiliency in us. And something that I teach on my website is, if you get curious and observant about yourself, you're going to see ingenious solutions that other people won't. You know, even a therapist, you're going to be able to know yourself better. We're not victims. We really have a big say in our own mental health.
I've been, you know, I've studied the world. I've been involved in the world of recovery for quite some time, Jewel. And when you talk about this, there's a phrase that in that community that it's act as if, or act your way into right thinking. That also, I don't know if that plays into this at all, but do you believe that people can behave their way and have their thought process follow suit? Or is this
degree,
all?
The trick is making sure it's not mental. So if our, let's say, affirmations are something most people know. So you're going to affirm what you want to believe, maybe look in the mirror and say, whatever. I'm lovable. If you feel like that's a lie, that's not going to work. So you have to tell yourself something that feels like the truth, that your whole body resonates with. And so to me, that's a difference between trying to neutralize something through sort of an antidote. If I'm happy, if I'm sad, make myself feel happy. when they're just mental, when our whole body doesn't feel stimulated, we're not going to get as much of an effect as we want.
Right.
The trick is getting your whole body to feel it. So if you can fake it till you make it in an authentic way, in a sincere way, the gratitude practice, I think, actually is a really good example. Mm-hmm. I tried to be grateful, but my whole body didn't feel it. It was just like, I'm grateful that I'm alive, but my body was screaming at me, no, you're not, you're miserable.
It's not it's not getting the message yet, right? You're not following the message.
Not getting the message. So you're not going to have that physiological response of the dilation. So the trick is you have to find things that are true that stimulate your whole system, no matter what your circumstance. For me, with the gratitude, I was on the street corner and I finally found something that really resonated with me for some reason. It was the sun shining through the tree and casting the shadow on my skin and feeling the warmth on my skin and the beautiful, strangely lacy pattern of the dappled sunlight. And it reminded me of a time when I was a kid, and it suddenly struck me that I was alive and I was lucky to be alive.
I'm a part of your lore, and I remember we talked about this around the time of either it was of your charity show or One Drop, or one of the moments was that you captured yourself, you saw yourself in a mirror or in a window while shoplifting a dress that was sort of an epiphany for you. Is that the right story? Is that one of the moments? If you could go back to that time, and what happened to the dress, first of all? Is that still, did you put the dress back, or did you carry it out, or is it part of your life at all?
The moment was when I was homeless. I was stealing a lot, and I was in a dressing room trying to steal a dress one day, and I caught my reflection and saw what I looked like and that I was a statistic. I moved out at 15. I knew kids like me end up becoming statistics, and I tried very hard not to be one. I was very thoughtful about it. I was mindful. I had this little journal I kept called my happiness project, and I knew I needed to learn new skills. And yeah, here I was 3 short years later, and I was homeless and shoplifting, and I realized I would be in jail or dead if I didn't change my life. And I remember this quote by Buddha that said, happiness doesn't depend on who you are or what you have. It depends on what you think. And so I decided to see if I could turn my life around one thought at a time. And that's hard when you have that much anxiety. You can't perceive your thoughts in real time. So I began to write about my hands, because the hands are the servants of your thoughts. So I thought maybe I could hack my way into my head and seeing what I'm thinking by watching my hands, because it's your thought cooled, slowed down into action. And so I did that for 2 weeks. That was my huge life plan. I didn't steal the dress, and I was like, all right, I'm going to write about my hands, I guess, for 2 weeks. The amazing side effect was my anxiety virtually disappeared while I was really focusing on what my hands were doing. And that was curious to me, right? It was a noticeable thing when your anxiety, that intense anxiety, can disappear. And that was the beginning for me of my what's called a mindfulness journey. But again, I didn't know that word at the time. I started getting very curious about, why does that work? What is the nature of anxiety? What is the nature of fear? Starting to realize there was this gap, looking at habits. How do I rewire habits? And for some reason, I had a talent for being observant and curious and then creating an exercise. And that's what's up on the Jewel Never Broken website. That's what our Inspiring Children Foundation in Vegas is founded on, are these exercises that it was amazing. A neuroscientist named Dr. Judson Brewer actually proved why they work, which was incredibly amazing to me, because, you know, as a homeless kid, you're just trying not to kill yourself and find a way to feel better. And the fact that it got turned into something that could actually help other people was really rewarding.
Yeah. You touched on a Las Vegas connection, obviously the Inspiring Children's Foundation. And I want to ask you a little bit about where the charity is now, and especially how you got to know Marty Hennessy. Because Marty and I have many common friends, and I was just talking to one today and brought Marty's name up, and the person I was talking to said that Marty is very involved in philanthropy, very involved in the tennis community. He said there is no more important tennis figure in Las Vegas than Marty Hennessy.
Yeah.
And he has done stuff that people don't really know about. And, we've known him as the director of the Sterling Club at Turnberry Place and things like that. How did you make that connection, first of all? And how is the status of the foundation right now?
Thanks. Yeah, my partner in the foundation is Ryan Wolfington, who founded it, about 18 or 19 years ago. And that was Marty. much better than I did. The foundation started because of my interest in mindfulness and helping people that didn't have other resources, didn't have access to therapy or traditional places to go when they were unhappy. There's no school to go learn a new emotional language. And Ryan and I were both fascinated by that. He's had his own journey, dropping out of a very unsatisfying corporate career and learning mindfulness, learning to meditate. And he saw a kid in Las Vegas on a street corner doing things he shouldn't be doing. And he befriended him and said, "What else do you do besides these things you shouldn't be doing?" And he said, "I play tennis." And he said, "All right, meet me on these free, just kind of in Lorenzi Park tennis courts." And they just started meeting every day. And he started talking to him about mindfulness. And the foundation really grew from there and has become one of the top tennis academies in the country. We don't recruit tennis players, but we've become the second ranked tennis organization for youth in the country. And that's really due to a lot of the mindfulness practices, how to learn to compete in a healthy way and against yourself. So you can remain productive and remain competitive without self-imploding, that a lot of athletes and musicians and even, you know, high-powered CEOs, we can implode under the weight of our own pressure. So the foundation's doing great. Last year, we teach them three things: entrepreneurial skills, mindfulness skills, and tennis. And we don't give them anything. So the kids run the foundation. They run the fundraisers. They run the videos and the video editing. And they run, they clean the buildings, everything. They learn to start their own little businesses. And they just become incredibly competent. They let go of their anger. They learn their thoughts and their feelings and their happiness are their own. And it's within their power. And last year, 99% of our kids earned their own college scholarships. And 90% of them were Ivy League, which is amazing. Because we're not recruiting like top academics, that, taking kids who are suicidal and dropping out.
These are lives that are built in that process. Like you said, you're not market testing here who's coming through the process. That's incredible.
All the kids' hard work. It is incredible. I don't know another foundation that has those stats. I'm very, very proud of them. And it really is because of Ryan and Trent and just the dedication. Each one of those kids each have to decide that they're going to take responsibility for their own happiness. And there's no excuse. That's a scary place to be, because how often do we like excuses? I'm not happy because of, because it lets us not be responsible. It's a big thing to take on that responsibility. And the fact that these kids do is just heroic to me.
Right, right. You had debuted your quarantine series in March, that Live from San Quarantine, on the Twitch TV / Inspire House platform. That's still an ongoing project, right? And that's tied into the charity as well.
Yeah, like many charities, we lost our ability to fundraise. We have about a $1.4 million budget annually to keep those programs going and our kids fed and in housing. And when COVID hit, we realized we couldn't go out and do our traditional fundraising that we do, which is doing concerts and live events and fundraising that way. So we just scrambled, and in 3 days, me and the kids put together this Live from San Quarantine benefit concert. We were able to raise $550,000 that night, which was unbelievable. But still only a small part of the way that we have to get to our annual budget. And so we've continued the series as a speaker series, and it's been a lot of fun. It's about mental health and music and just helping people through this time. Our kids are these amazing warriors who are specially equipped for times like this. When you have these mindfulness skills, when you know that your head can mess with you, when you know what to do when you get anxious, you're going to be okay during times like COVID. You take responsible action, and you know that worry is wasteful. It's a waste of our energy. And so you have to apply that energy and dedicate it to something else, responsible action or creativity or community service or anything. So our kids end up having these incredible skill sets and Alive a lot to share. So they have the Inspire House on Twitch, where they mentor people, where they teach meditation, where they help people with their anxiety. And I do a speaker series every Thursday, later today, and where we talk with different people from, everybody from the heads of psychology departments at Harvard to actors who have talked really openly about their struggles with anxiety and just sort of the great common denominator that all of us have brains. And why don't we talk about what it's like to own one and how do we use it and how do we use our emotions because we're not against dental hygiene and physical hygiene, but mental hygiene is rarely talked about.
Yeah, that's true. You can talk about any other, you know, like you bring up tennis, and athletes will often talk about their physical maladies and, you know, if they're recovering from a torn ACL or something like that. But when it gets into mental health, there seems to be a reluctance to really go there, you know, and I think that's what's so impressive about your work is that you're willing to, you have that gift of being, of drawing people in, you know, not just kids, but everybody into that process. You feel real comfortable doing it. So that's to be commended. I wanted to ask you also about the, you brought up mindfulness, the term, and your, the documentary has that title in that you worked on with Deepak Chopra, the mindfulness movement. And that's available now online, right? That feature documentary. Could talk about that a little bit. What was the inspiration and how did you get connected with Mr. Chopra?
Yeah, when we were forming the foundation, Ryan and I, mindfulness was not a term. Meditation we had heard of, but it was kind of for hippies and new age people. You know, it wasn't like this grounded thing. It's been a wonderful thing now to see it become a common phrase in pop culture, where Time Magazine has it on the cover every year. And the movie really just talks about, well, what is mindfulness? Because the weird's kind of a weird word. To me, it just means consciously being present. It's building the skill to learn to be consciously present. And when you're consciously present, you do better. You do better in a meeting because you see things and perceive things other people are spacing out on. You do better at learning a craft or a skill or a sport because the more present you are, the more powerful you are, right? The more present you are to get better, to make those tiny little adjustments that are going to give you increases in gains that somebody else might not. And then the science behind it. What happens when we dilate? What happens with our neurotransmitters? How does it work? Showing that you can grow gray matter in 8 weeks. You can grow your brain and shrink your amygdala. It's amazing. And so just helping people understand the science and those types of things, as well as seeing how useful it is. It does things nothing else can do for frontline responders, for Navy SEALs, for, you know, it's one of the main tools that Navy SEALs learn to slow their heart rate, for instance. And so just helping understand basically what it is more. And I've known Deepak off and on over the years, so it was really fun to work on that with him as well.
This is 2020 is the anniversary, 25th anniversary of Pieces of You, the breakthrough album for you. Your break, I guess, is the best way to explain it. What do you think about that? Do you have a chance to really reflect on your commercial success as an artist? Do you have much chance to appreciate that? And what is the? Can you say what the album means to you today?
The fact that that album was able to be commercially successful was the aggregate, just the culmination of so much hard work on my part, but on an entire fan base's part that fought to help a folk singer break through a really male-dominated, grunge-oriented business. It was the entire help of an entire staff of a record label who stayed up till 10 at night, begging people to play my record. It was me doing 1,000 shows a year, 5 and 6 shows a day for years on end to try and make that record breakthrough. The fact that it was so successful was really against so many odds, and it changed my life. And I got to be validated for being who I was. I never had to change or compromise or be somebody that I wasn't. And it was incredibly touching.
Yeah, it seems from this side of it, there was no mechanism in place to make that album a hit. There was no existing path. You know, that's what was amazing about it. There was no industry paradigm, you know.
it was a real outlier and took a ton of work.
Right.
I was laughed out of every radio station, laughed out of every establishment. Told I was dumb, naive, would never make it, you know, but people just thought, I thought, and then I just built this belief, this grassroots army, and people at my label believed in me, and we just kept going.
Yeah, exactly. It chills just thinking about that whole process even today. What? How about the new album? Is there any timeline for when that will be finished, released, and even and what the title of it will be?
It has two songs that are currently released. One's called No More Tears and one is called Grateful. I don't know when the rest of the music will be released. It's such an unprecedented time in history. Obviously, the way that we typically release music around tours can't be done. So I'll find my way through this like all the other artists. But I'm very excited by the music. This is the first time I've written a record from scratch. I've always been prolific, so I've had thousands of songs in my back catalog. So every album was written kind of years in advance. I just had to go through my catalog and pick out the songs that I wanted, despite what genre it was. I always wrote all these styles. So this is the first time I wrote a record from scratch, which was a bizarre process and very difficult. I wrote 200 songs to get 10 that I liked. The record's sort of a soul record. I was very influenced by Donny Hathaway and Bill Withers and a lot of 70s soul and kind of political soul music. And so you really hear that influence on this record.
Yeah. Withers, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. He just passed away. He really touched a lot of people, Bill Withers. I hadn't really appreciated him until he passed away, but yeah. Do you have a title in mind for it? Are you still working that out?
I'm still working it out. I'm so bad at titles. Really, really horrible at them.
And I'll wrap it up with this. I've seen you in Las Vegas a lot, and I don't know. Do you still have a residence or a presence in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I have a piece of land out at Lake Las Vegas. I'm overwhelmed by the community in Las Vegas. Very good friends with Tony Shea. He and I were building a business, and I was working on the CERC project. My foundation, of course, is there, and was just there during the Vegas Strong era, which was tragic and very inspiring to see how the community came together. It's such a small town. It's not what I thought. You know, I thought it was just going to be sort of this cold-hearted showbiz town, and it's a small town at the end of the day. You know, everybody knows everybody. Mm-hmm. People look after one another. I was very touched by that community.
Yeah, that's another time we ran into each other at the Vegas Cares event at the Venetian. And we went through that whole thing when you sang Mercy. And you've been a part of some recovery projects and restoration projects in Las Vegas specifically, Jewel. And I know our community really appreciates it. Do you think down the line you'll ever want to do some sort of residency or something akin to like what One Night for One Drop was a production that's centered on your life? Has there ever been discussion about that happening in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I've looked at a couple different things. Nothing has quite, been right. Hard to find that sweet spot of something that feels really intimate and can also do its job. It's a fantastic community. I do look forward to figuring that out. And in the meantime, I love the community and I've always really appreciated the support and I've always been honored to be a part of the community and doing shows like that Cirque show was just incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fabulous. All right. Well, I do appreciate your time once again. And we're just going to continue to follow all of it, Jewel. And, your team can reach out to me anytime. And I'm available to tell the folks about it. And just be well. And we'll talk to you down the line again. I'm sure of that.
Sounds great. Have a great day.
Thanks once more to Jewel for joining us this week on Podcats. We'll be back next Monday and every Monday, so be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. What is happening in the column, you might be asking yourselves? Well, we spoke with Cirque du Soleil CEO Daniel Lamar about the company's attempts to stay afloat during COVID-19. The company has been boosted by a cash infusion from its investors, and Lamar remains confident that it can return to full strength. That is a big deal in Las Vegas. Penn Jillette and John DiDomenico, two recent Podcats guests, are now on the website Cameo. This is where entertainers and celebrities record custom video messages for a fee. Many Las Vegas performers are now on that platform. MGM Resorts International has cut many top-level positions, including four hotel presidents. This is all in a COVID-19 narrowing of its management team. Axl Rose of Guns N' Roses and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin wound up in a Twitter feud last week. Yes, that happened, and it's highly entertaining and extremely random. And we get to know the Vegas Events COVID-19 Committee. This is more than 30 venue and resort heavyweights in town who are building a set of guidelines for live entertainment and sporting events to return to Las Vegas. All that and more in Cats. That closes out another episode of Podcats. Thank you, Frankie Moreno, for our theme song, The Biggest Cat in Town. Keep up with me, or try to, on the Review Journal website, or at Johnny Katz on Twitter, at Johnny Katz 1 on Instagram, and tune in next Monday to the next installment of Podcats. Well, it's a jungle out there, baby, and I'm the biggest cat in town.